Hey, good evening, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. Good evening. My name is Christy Tibbles. I'm actually with the Board of Game, but with Board Support Section here to help with the meeting tonight. I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank the Commissioner for being here tonight for this meeting, and then as well as a number of agency staff who are in the room and also online. I want you to know that there's copies of the Yukon River Agreement available here on this table. And for those of you who are online and on the phone, a copy of the agreement has been posted to the online public meeting notice, which can be found at notice.alaska.gov/214465. Commissioner, before I just describe a little bit on how the process is, do you want to say a couple words first, or shall I? Okay, so folks, in the interest of time, we ask that members serving on fish and game advisory committees are given priority to provide feedback to the department. If time allows, we will open comments up to all members of the public. Please keep your comments brief, less than 3 minutes, to allow opportunity for everyone to speak. To ensure that those joining online and over the phone are given equal opportunity to speak, we will alternate between the in-person and online speakers. For those joining online, please use the raise hands feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. For those joining by phone, please press *9 to raise your hand when your name is called, or for those of you on the phone, when you hear the last 3 digits of your phone number called, the meeting host, and that's Kyle Campbell, so folks will hear his voice through this meeting. The meeting host will unmute you, and you may begin speaking. So we'll go ahead and begin with folks in the room. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to the commissioner, then we will begin with folks in the room. Thank you.
Well, hello, everyone. Hey, and thanks for coming. Yukon River Center. This has been something that I've been very interested in since I became commissioner 6 years ago. I travel around the Yukon River numerous occasions. I think I've done almost all the TCC tours except for 1 year. I've been most of the different villages. I've gone to the TCC annual meetings. I think I was there just recently, as 4 or 5 days ago, took questions from the TCC chiefs. I understand how important subsistence is. I truly do. It's the lifeblood of fish and game, or the lifeblood of that region. And right now, Chinook salmon are not doing well in the Yukon River. Chum salmon weren't doing well for a couple of years, but I'm glad to say that at least last year we met our minimum escaping goal of 500,000. I think we put 800,000 in the river, and we were able to provide some subsistence opportunity in summer chums in the lower river. That was good. I understand that it's not how you traditionally fish summer chums, because you use gill nets and a variety of other things, but we have to somehow protect our Chinook salmon and rebuild those runs. Fall chums are also showing some signs of improvement. We've actually got closer. I think we actually met our escaping goal for fall chums, but that was with no fishing on them at all. So that's not success in our point of view. We have to not only have meet our escaping goals, not only we have to provide some sustainable harvest opportunities, especially for subsistence people. Chinook salmon are not doing well. Bottom line, they're not doing well in Canada, and they're not doing well in Canada. It's been pretty fantastic when we were talking to Canada over the course of the last 2 years that we need to take some positive steps to try to rebuild our Chinook salmon runs in the Yukon River. We've been taking steps for the last 4 or 5 years. We've been restricting gear types that are used in the main Sin River to try to pass fish, especially up into the upper river drainages, and especially into Canada, which has been really having dismal returns. Just give you an example. We had passed 12,000 fish 10 years ago at the White Horse Dam. Last year was less than 1,000. So we are taking steps in the main stem as chum salmon fishing occurs to protect those fish as they move forward, as they move upriver. That's selective gear. It's not the kind of gear that you've traditionally fished. I understand that. But we have to rebuild those stocks. And it's in our best interest. Let me make it clear. It's in our best interest for Canada to rebuild those stocks. We are going to be limited in our ability to harvest chum salmon and other stocks on our side of the border, even Chinook salmon if they start building on our side of the border, if we're not meeting our Canadian passage objectives. Those fish are 40% of the fish that are in that river, 45% of the fish. And if we're meeting U.S. escaping goals, we're not meeting Canadian escapement goals, we're going to continue to be struggling in our how we're going to provide chum salmon opportunities in the lower river. So we got together with DFO two years ago, and it got more interesting this last year. They were getting a lot of pressure by First Nations to list Canadian origin Chinook salmon under what they call their ESA, which is SARA, Species at Risk Act. There was a lot of reluctance to do that because with, just like an ESA on our side of the border, a lot of things happen when a species is listed. And they were trying to get some kind of assurance that we're going to continue to help them rebuild their Canadian origin Chinook salmon stocks on their side of the river. So we sat down and kind of crafted out an agreement that was in the best interest of both us and them, because if they're listed under the SARA Act in Canada, under U.S. law, they could be listed under ESA on our side of the border. And an ESA listing on our side of the border means critical habitat up and down that entire part of the Yukon River, as well as incidental take permits for any kind of fishing that occurs. Not something that we're, as a government, are interested in seeing. So we started crafting through an agreement. And basically what we have in this agreement is that we're going to basically continue. Well, here's another thing. We heard loud and clear that the current way of managing fisheries isn't working in the Yukon. That is annual management. It was time. I met a couple times with the Yukon panel on both sides of the border, and I heard that we need a different approach. We need to look at a life cycle of Chinook salmon. So we started crafting through an agreement that looked at a 7-year life cycle. And what we can do to rebuild Chinook salmon in the Yukon River over that 7-year life cycle. And that included continuing to manage conservatively in the main stem portions of the U.S., in both the main stem river, in both in Canada and the United States. That means that we're going to continue over a 7-year period of time, making sure that what we're currently doing to protect those stocks is going to be implemented over that 7-year period of time. And that's to try to assure Canada that we're going to take those measures by agreement moving forward. So we also set a recovery objective for our Canadian origin fish at the border, and that's 71,000. I know it's a lofty goal, but we see value in rebuilding those stocks, because if we get to a rebuilt Canadian stock, we're going to be harvesting those Canadian stocks on our side of the border again. And that's something I think we all would like to get back to, is harvesting Chinook salmon. The other thing that happens is that we agreed to put a moratorium in place on sport, commercial, and personal use fishing over that 7-year period of time, and all subsistence fishing in the main stem river. Now, if we start meeting escapement goals on our side of the border in our tributaries, we would be able to fish in our tributaries where we're not hitting Canadian origin fish in those tributaries. So like if the Chena River starts hitting its escapement objectives on our side of the border, we could, again, open up fisheries in those areas on those fisheries. We also agreed that the only reason the primary reason we're doing this is to rebuild harvest opportunity. But we don't want to completely cut off cultural and traditional uses of salmon while we're rebuilding these runs. It's like in Canada, they haven't fished Chinook salmon for 10 or 12 years. And we both, on both sides of the border, we fundamentally agree that it's really important to provide some kind of level of very limited subsistence opportunity so that over the period of rebuilding, we can protect that culture and allow for traditions to be passed on. So that's built into this. Then finally, we got pieces of this that are built into it that recognize that the panel itself really needs to focus on what it takes to recover the stock. So we were going to task the Yukon panel with building and constructing a rebuilding plan for Chinook salmon in the Yukon River. And I know a lot of people are going to go, I'll be ballistic over this, but part of that includes how Canada's going to deal with hatcheries moving forward. I know a lot of people don't want to have hatcheries in the Yukon River anywhere, but right now I can tell you Canada is at a place where they're losing genetic integrity of some of their small stocks. They're not looking at production level hatcheries where they're going to try to produce a lot of Chinook to basically get into a commercial fishery. But at this point in time, they want to, and they need to, from my perspective, ensure that the genetic integrity of those stocks are maintained. And from my seat, I can tell you, after visiting the White Horse Dam hatchery, we do not want that as a model hatchery of how they do conservation hatcheries in Canada. We want that done in a manner that protects our interests moving forward and actually does promote genetic integrity rather than having a mishmash of genetics up in that upper river system. So I know that's a controversial issue, but we're not looking at, I don't think either side of the border right now is looking at production level hatcheries, but at this point in time in Canada, they are looking at at conservation hatcheries, and if we're gonna, they're gonna do it, we want to be at that table to make sure they're done right. So, did I miss anything?
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm Danny Evanson. I'm an extended jurisdiction program manager with the department. I serve as the commissioner's policy advisor on all matters concerning treaty. And Yukon is Chapter 8 of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And I just think I'll put a finer point on a few things that you said. This agreement is groundbreaking and at the same time symbolic. Simply symbolic, one might say. It's groundbreaking and it has a lot of new elements. It's symbolic in that we're just continuing the same old that we had this year, except with an eye towards the future. One of the things that I really think is groundbreaking here, we all know in our policy and statute and regulation, subsistence is the highest priority. I think this is the first time we put in writing the recognition of the importance of fish for use, for ceremony, and for the transmission of cultural knowledge, and really recognizing that that element of the subsistence fishery is even more important when the fish runs are so low that you can't have a subsistence fishery that we'd all like to see. I think that's really important to recognize. It is free from international obligation, so it allows Alaska to make those decisions without asking Canada, and allows Canada to do similarly, although that is expected to be somewhat limited. Other areas, this just is continuing what we've been doing, but across a seven-year horizon, recognizing these are approaching a significant conservation concern, and we want to do all that we can. It does call for a rebuilding plan, as the commissioner mentioned, and we'd like to look forward and think about the things we can do to increase these runs. And with that comes a commitment from both Alaska and Canada to pursue extra funds coming in to the river to restore habitat and look, as the commissioner said, to some of those conservation style hatcheries in Canada that are designed to maintain genetics, not designed to do industrial production of fish. And I think I'll leave it there, but before we open it up to questions and I hand off the mic, I want to introduce some of our staff that are in the room who will also be here to answer questions. We have our summer season manager, Dina Jellin. We have Christy Gleason, our fall season manager. We have John Linderman on the line. He's the regional supervisor for commercial fisheries. Chuck Brazil, who's the regional manager for AYK. We have Caroline Brown from our subsistence division, who is here to answer questions as well, recognizing I need to phone a friend often. We have Holly Carroll, our federal manager from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service online. So we have a lot of other staff in the room, but those are the ones that have been that are here to answer questions. I don't think I can name them all. I see Lisa Stubbe from Sportfish. I see Alita Trainer from Subsistence Division. I see our Director of Wildlife back there, Ryan Scott. And I think I saw our Director of Sportfish, Israel Payton. So you have a complete end, Amy Witta. You have a complete suite.
So I think that last part's really important, is that we made a commitment to get additional money into the Yukon. I know I and Danny both have approached Senator Murkowski with the need to increase both research funding in the Yukon River as well as increase funding to the panel. That panel money's been stagnant for about 10 years, 12 years now. It has not kept up with the cost of inflation, and it's time to get that bumped up. And I've heard very positive responses back from the senator to, especially if we have this agreement signed, to get this money in flowing into the thing so that we can, again, focus on rebuilding. So.
Okay, can you hear me now? Hi, my name is Gail Vick, and I chair the Fisheries Subcommittee for the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory. I had asked the department to have this meeting during the Board of Game because people up and down the river are really concerned about this agreement at different levels. They have a lot of questions. I don't want to take up people's time. We want to hear from people on the river. But my only suggestion is that we have a comprehensive rebuilding plan that includes everybody, that we have a systematic way of talking to people and getting information out and having people participate in this process. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Gail. Thank you, Commissioner Danny. We'll go ahead and start taking names. So just a reminder, and for folks that may have just joined, we have copies of the agreement up here. It's also posted online at notice.alaska.gov/214465. And then we are going to begin with folks in the room. And again, what the priority, and because of the interest in time, we're taking the comments from advisory committee members first. So please raise your hand if you wish to speak. And then when I bring you the microphone, just speak clearly to the microphone, close to the microphone and clearly, and state which advisory committee you serve on. We'll do five here in the room, and then we'll alternate, and we'll have folks online, advisory committee members online, have the opportunity to speak or ask questions too. So please raise your hand if you're interested in.
I'm from the town, the Rampart Manly Advisory Committee. And I got three or four quick questions. I want to know why the agreement only talks about kings, and when we have other salmon that need to make escapement in order for us to eat, in order for us to enhance. It says in the agreement that all salmon species have to make escapement first. That's one question. And for 20 years, the guy started fishing down the mouth, and then we get cut off when the escapement is not going to be met. So I have to ask, if in the future, we cut summer chums all my life. You know, they make it way up the river. So my ask is that when you get numbers, to share that fish along the river, not only on one part of the river. We're all hungry. We all need the fish. We're all at the point of no other means. So I just want to ask that you think about people river-wide. That's kind of all I had to say. That all mixed into two questions, and I think that it's real important that we include the chums some way and worry about them just the same. And they'll be. Oh, Charlie Wright. I'm sorry.
So, Charlie, we tried to focus it on species that had a Canadian-U.S. interface. Coho salmon really are not that species. Summer chums aren't that species. There's fall chums. We could have included them, but we decided to focus this initially on Chinook. Chinook is the thing that has basically been in the long-term decline, and it's time to do it. We did not want to have, at least I wasn't interested in having Canada tell us how to manage our summer chum salmon runs. They're on our side of the border. They're not part of that treaty. So, again, keeping them out of there. In terms of how we're managing the river for the Middle River versus Lower River, you're right. It's a challenge. And that's especially a challenge in a patchwork environment where you have federal, state, tribal management, a whole variety of things going up the river. We'll try to do a better job of managing those summer chums. And I expect this year we're going to have probably close to a million chums in the river this summer for summer chums. And that's going to present a challenge in how we manage that fishery to pass Chinook. They're important for the U.S. side of the border as well as the Canadian side of the border, and then how we're passing Chinook to ensure that Lower River and Middle River people have an opportunity to fish them. But we'll engage people, as we currently do, in those discussions.
Who's next?
Hi, Commissioner. Staff, thank you all for being here today. My name is Olivia Hanahi Irwin. I'm the co-chair of the Minchonee-Nana Advisory Committee. And Commissioner Lang, I want to first thank you for your comments at both the last Board of Fish meeting as well as coming to our Tanana Chiefs Conference Annual Convention for continuing to include educational and cultural purposes for our fish in the conversation. And I'm wondering how our tribes are going to be able to utilize this cultural and educational opportunity. To me, it doesn't seem like it's completely outlined in the agreement, and so I want to ensure that our tribes know how to access that. I want to know which tribes will be able to access that. Many of our tribes on the upper end of the river have had many, many years of not being able to fish because of summer chum, fall chum, and Chinook openings on the lower river. Our people in 5D are hungry, and they're needing salmon for potlatch ceremony and for educational purposes. And so I'm wondering exactly what is your plan for engaging tribes in that educational and ceremonial purposes and ensuring that our tribes do get that and it's not just an empty promise written on paper. Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question. So I think the first thing this agreement does is it recognizes for the first time that even though we're not meeting escapement goals, that we have to provide for cultural and traditional purposes. So I think that's a really important milestone that we've made in this agreement, both on both sides of the border. Because I think in the past we kept hearing we're not meeting escapement goals, there's no take of fish anywhere in that river system. So I think we're recognizing in this agreement that we're going to allow some takes so people can get their hands on fish and pass that tradition on and culture going on. We purposely left it undefined because we did not want to have too much definition put around this until we have an opportunity to hold series of meetings like this, quite frankly, to talk to people how we're going to do it. I can tell you there's probably a lot more opportunity to touch chums in the next couple of years than there are Chinook salmon. But that said, I think we're going to provide some opportunity, very limited, I'm going to say, to get people's hands on Chinook salmon, recognizing the cultural importance of Chinook salmon in the meantime. So I'll be frank with you, I don't know what that looks like yet, but it's going to involve everybody around these rooms and the villages up and down as to how we can do that. And we're going to have some community cooperation and sharing. You know, maybe there's a culture camp set up for five or six different communities where you can pass those traditions on. But again, I think there's opportunity to be more for chum salmon in the short term, and hopefully in the long term, you know, some additional chum salmon is available.
We have another advisory committee member wishing to speak. We do have an advisory committee member online. We'll turn to that person first.
Hello, Victor Lord here. Hello. Hello.
Hello, yep, we can hear you. Could you state your name and your advisory committee, please?
Yeah, Victor Lord, United Mitchell Advisory Committee, longstanding member, this is the late 70s. I just wanted to, can I go ahead and show my spiel out now?
Yep, go ahead.
I echo what Olivia is saying and Charlie is saying. But I'm really concerned about the Tan River. I heard Doug say something about if the fish are bouncing back within that 7-year period, the Tan River possibly may be able to fish. But my concern was we always agreed to go along with whatever the Yukon was doing because to keep peace and harmony. But a 7-year stop, I have a hard time explaining to my people they can't fish in the Fishing River. It's tough enough as it is. Other thing is, our culture camp is very important to us, especially now. Try to teach the kids how to do it. We've been doing it by mail. We check the fish net by mail. We go down to the post office to get our fish. But it certainly is nice. We've had our fish camp so long that I had the kids in the boat and they've seen the fish come out of the reel and that hooks them right there. But then the same thing to me as a 5-year-old. Long time ago. But anyway, it helps you. You pay attention to what the person tried to teach you. You got all day lessons picking up fish, putting up the bank for cutting, for how long to hang it in the air, for the weather, for the rain. All that's so important. And Like, people take a lot of pride in their smoked fish. Well, that's amazing, and thanks, Doug, for, and thank you, Gail, for enlightening us for this special meeting. Thank you. On a bad day, ciao.
Yeah, if I could just hit another point of this agreement is that I think on both sides of the border, I met with, you know, the tribes and the U.S. side of the border, I met with the First Nations. There was a general desire to incorporate traditional local ecological knowledge into the decision frameworks. This agreement recognizes the importance of that information and the importance of integrating that information into the panel process as we do rebuilding and we do recovery of these stocks. So that's something that you hadn't seen in previous agreements, but this is going to be critical, especially as we move into rebuild and getting that information incorporated into the plan. So.
Thank you. I think everybody's got my name and number.
Okay, next we're going to go to Karma online.
Hi, my name is Chief Karma Albee from the Native Village of Eagle. I'm also the chair of the Eagle Fish and Game Basin. I think most of our members are in support of this agreement. We feel like the drastic declines are calling for the state to implement restrictions to save our Chinook. I really do feel like tribes and communities along the river should be consulted on major decisions like this, though, that affect our way of life and how we feed our families. I do want to thank you for the limited harvest for ceremonial use and the transition of cultural knowledge. I'm curious to see what that looks like, but I strongly encourage the state to seriously look at the marine environment. I think in putting in-river restrictions on our fisheries, it won't be beneficial unless we really put some restrictions on Area M and the trawl bycatch. And I think that we really need to protect the chum at this point, too, and incidental catch of Chinook. So, thank you for hearing me today.
Yeah, thank you. We've talked many times about, you know, Area M and the Bering Sea trawl fisheries. We're committed as a state to tackling those issues. I know there wasn't a lot of happiness over the Area M meeting as to how we got to a solution, but the solution that was put in place last year actually brought chum salmon harvest down in that fishery from 1.2 million 2 years ago to 200,000 this past year. So I know there's a lot of disagreement over how we got there and whether that was the right way to get there, but we did take steps to reduce that chum salmon intercept. We are now in the process of collecting genetic information on Chinook salmon, and that information will then inform steps we may take in the Area M fishery, depending on what we find out on there, to how we may carve time or area out of that fishery to pass Chinook salmon through it. So, again, the first piece of that is collecting the information. I think we learned a lot when we collected information on chums, that 80% of those chums are Asian chums, and we wanted to make sure we were doing it in a way that didn't just protect it, you know, to reduce the harvest on Asian chums. Now, in the Bering Sea, we are committed to taking an action in the Bering Sea that will be heard at the April Council meeting, I think in 2 weeks. I encourage you all to come and voice your concern about that. But I can tell you that that's a lot trickier than what the Council did with Chinook salmon. In Chinook salmon, almost all those Chinook salmon are origin from the AYK drainages. There are not a lot of Chinook salmon of Asian origin that are out in the Bering Sea. So we tied it to the Three River Index, and right now we have a cap of 12,500 Chinook, which is basically being fished at a level of about 6,000 Chinook. And when you cross that across all the drainages and you turn them into adult equivalents, it's a meaningful reduction in chum salmon out there that are returning back. But with chum salmon, 80% are, again, nearly 75-80% of those are Asian chums that are caught in that trawl fishery. What we don't want to do is take an action where we reduce the chum salmon bycatch out there and force them into Chinook salmon. I mean, chum salmon bycatch and force them into Chinook salmon waters or other areas that are important for Chinook salmon like herring. So I know we're not going very fast, but we want to make sure that the law of unintended consequences doesn't come back and bite us here. And we only reduce chum salmon, 80% of which is Asian chum hatchery fish, and end up harvesting more Chinook salmon. So We're committed to doing it, but I just want you to know that there's reasons why we're going slow so we don't end up having the unintended consequences of doing something more damaging than what we're saving.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karma. Do we have any other advisory committee members in the audience?
Thank you. Commissioner, thanks for coming to speak with us. Many in the room, like Minto Nenana, Fairbanks advisory committees, have been concerned about the salmon problem on the Yukon. Well, I've been on the advisory committee just about the same amount of time Mr. Lord has, and we were worried about it when we started back at the end of the 70s. My question is, though, more of a numbers one, and that is why you picked a seven-year cycle. You don't have any seven-year fish out there, so why are we just being optimistic here?
Yes, thank you for that question. The reason we chose the seven-year horizon...
Closer.
Okay. It just feels so loud. The reason we chose the seven-year horizon was based on what we were hearing from folks along the river, that the way we've been doing things 1 year at a time isn't working. I mean, that's something else that's groundbreaking about this agreement, is that we are looking across the seven-year horizon. And historically, particularly in the 70s, and then they started declining, there were quite a few seven-year-old fish in this river. There were seven-year-old stream type and seven-year-old ocean type fish. That life history has all but disappeared, but it was looking at that complete life cycle based on feedback we have received from folks along the river, many of the elders, the UConn panel at the different AC meetings. That's the feedback we've received.
Yeah, we want to get 7 year fish back into this river.
All right. My apologies. I totally skipped this person.
Yes, thank you for coming. This is Eva Burke. I'm with the Minto Nenana Advisory Committee. And I really want to echo what Karma was saying, that I just don't see how this agreement is going to be very effective, because we've already been not fishing on Chinook. So unless we really take a serious action that we can see in like the next 2 years, because that's when the next board of fish is, so all of these people in the room are really going to be working on the proposals for that board of fish to do something in Area M. So I don't see it in here enough in the writing and in the plans, but also like what I would feel would be more reasonable and should be included in a rebuilding plan is this concept of a conservation corridor that the Board of Fish has been doing in Cook Inlet, and that has seemed to stabilize the king salmon population since they've been doing it, instead of having these like big ups and downs. And so that's where, in that conservation corridor, we would be able to look at those time area closures and understanding that timing change, right? So there has to be real-time genetic data to make this conservation corridor work. And there definitely is in the bycatch. When you start looking at the North Pacific data, there are definitely areas and genetic clusters that are the inshore fleet. There is a lot of I feel like very pointed data that points to a conservation corridor that shows clearly that in certain times and areas we are catching more Chinook and we are catching more chum. So I just really want you to realize that we don't want to just see these agreements made and then we have this Q&A. We want to be, when you're talking about bringing local knowledge, tribal entities, traditional knowledge, we need to be sitting down together more frequently to get to those solutions, because they can't be just your solutions. And also, like, I didn't hear anybody really bring up the hatchery issue, and you did call out specifically in the agreement that mentioning competition from hatchery production as a factor of environmental degradation, but... and then you keep pointing to this 80% Asian chum. But if you were to take that 80% Asian chum out of the way and only look at Alaska stock a significant portion of that is going to be coastal Western Alaska. And that competition from those Asian hatchery fish, it is an important issue, but we cannot start going to North Pacific and to these other countries and talking about hatchery reductions when we're releasing 1.4 to 1.8 billion juvenile salmon each year. So I really want to see stronger language, and we are really paying attention right now to what the state of Alaska is doing. So I just, you know, this is kind of a question slash comment, and then also back to what Charlie Wright was saying, you know, when you're doing, like you said it yourself, you have not been managing salmon well. So when you do a pre-season forecast, that pre-season forecast has a lot of error. And then, like they said, the river is open. I have the escapement for the in-river stocks and the amount of commercial salmon, chum specifically, that's been happening. So when you're doing your forecast, like on the fall chum is very important to the First Nations. They are, in fact, freezing the fall chum and then taking it out the next summer for their first fish camp. So it is really important that we include these fall chum. And so when we're, and it, I really don't think there should be any commercial fishing, chum or Chinook, in the next 7 years because of the possibility of incidental take of Chinook. But also, if you're going to increase that number at the Canadian border, sound science and management would to be increase it for chum at pilot station as well. And that's just because with the fish are getting smaller, we need more spawners on the spawning grounds. So, like, for example, the 2023 fall chum salmon forecast was for 251,000 fish, but it has a range of 112,000 to 602,000 fish. So we really need to be, we can't be basing openings based on that escapement. That's the problem right there. And I really agree with Charlie is if we work with the local fishermen, we can understand what those staggerings need to be, the timing of those as the fish move up. We have a really good handle on how long it takes fish to get upriver. And to really recognize, and this is not to put anybody to say they don't rely on chum, but I was just reading in this North Pacific Fisheries Management Salmon Bycatch document, chum salmon, that the lower Yukon people actually have a higher reliance on marine mammals and less reliance on summer chum. And like Charlie said, we cut summer chum. We catch so much kings that we don't have as much room for that summer chum to dry it, but we're definitely going in there, and it makes some very nice oily dry fish. So there's also misunderstanding that the summer chum are only spawning in those first 700 miles of the river. That's not quite true. So maybe majority before or historically, but things are changing. So I know that was a lot, but we'll see each other again, right, Doug?
Thank you.
Yeah, so there was a lot in there. And that's very, this kind of information that we need. Quite frankly, this is what we need to hear. I think one of the things I heard is concepts like conservation corridors. They take data, you know, and we're actually working towards those goals. You know, right now we're collecting the data on genetics and area. For instance, we need to know the timing of specific stocks going through area, and that's genetics. That tells us when those fish are moving through and when we need to take actions to potentially restrict or manage that fishery better to pass those chums, I mean, those fish through it. In the Yukon River, in Bering Sea, we've been meeting with industry. Part of the problem is when you're out there looking for Chinook salmon, there's 10,000 pollock caught for every one Chinook salmon that's caught. So it's very hard to do that testing on the deck, just simply try to find a Chinook salmon amongst 10,000 pollocks is just hard. So most of that sampling, it's 100% sample, is most of the Chinook salmon are sampled when they come back to dock, where they're landed into an off-sea processor. By then, there's a lot of mixture. You know, some of those trawl nets, fishermen are fishing three different sites or four different sites over five or six different days. So there's a lot of talk about real-time fishery collection of genetics out there. But the fact is that those trawls that are reported back, by the time you get your hands on those Chinook, is probably from about potentially 300 or 400 miles difference over 4 or 5 different days. We're trying to tackle that. We're trying to work with the fleet on how we can get better sampling of that real time. So if we can see them on the deck, we can mark them as to that trawl location and that date and time so we can do the genetics later. So we're making progress on that because we want that information as badly as you do. We want to know what the timing is of those fish catches going through. Right now we know what they are in general areas and you know, by week and things, but that's often not sufficient enough to do Chinook salmon bycatch management at the level that we need to do that because, again, we're talking only about 6,000 Chinook out there. So we're getting there. And then in the river, I think you're right. I think we need to do better talking to fishermen. And we do a really good job. Our staff really does. They have the weekly meetings, and they're talking to fishermen all the time. I'm pretty impressed when I go up and down the river on how much interaction is going on up and down the river, and that includes Holly Carroll from the Fish and Wildlife Service. Everybody's talking out there. This is how we can do it. But speak up. You know, get your opinions heard on how we can move, how we can manage the lower river to ensure that people living in your neck of the woods get some of those summer chums moving forward. So you got our commitment to have continued dialogue moving forward. And we all need science.
Okay, I see someone with your hand up. And for those listening online, if you're wanting to speak, be sure to raise your hand. But if you're on via phone, hit the button to *9 to raise your hand. And remember to say your name.
My name is Ron Yatsman. I'm with the Yukon Flats Advisory Committee. And currently, all the regulations, fishing regulations, is made by the Board of Fish here in Alaska. It seems like they need to be educated as much as anybody else. So if we're going to be making regulations about, or however you're going to do it, regulations about the fish, I sure would like to see their participation in these meetings. And as far as I know, none of them are present. Thank you.
I think that's a good point. I know that they take trips across Alaska when they're invited to go out in summertime on some of those trips. If TCC wanted to offer that invitation to some Board of Fish members rather than just the Commissioner of Fish and Game, I think you may get some of those members coming out on a 2 or 3 day tour. It's hard for them to do, 7 day tour or a variety of other things, but you might get them if you invite them out to your villages and they are very interested in learning. I can tell you that.
So I'm not sure if you still wanted to speak, but I have Alyssa Nadine Rogers. You had raised your hand. And Alyssa, if you are trying to speak, you're currently muted. You'll have to press the unmute on your screen. And if not, no worries. We'll move on to the next person.
Anyone else online, Kyle?
He said to be nice. But anyway, I just had a few questions, and this is Tom Crisco with Middle Yukon Advisory. I was concerned about, you know, the state just making a agreement across the board, kind of seemed like flew right over us because the feds, I don't know if they have anything, were in on the agreement or whatever. And then a few things that concerned me. I sat here during all the whole board of game or, you know, the testimonies, and I seen a few people talking about hatcheries on the Kaikuk River. And now you talked about hatcheries in the coming out of Canada. It kind of concerns me a little bit that in both situations that you had, you know, you had little information for them. For hatcheries, and you know, a lot of my concerns is about you know, you're designing something that I don't know how it will work or anything, but I've kind of I don't know. We're stuck in the middle, regardless of what your decisions. And it really kind of scares me, because I don't worry about me. Like the guy said, you and we'll all be gone by the time this happens. But I worry about my grandkids, and I hope you worry about yours too. And there's one other thing. Then you said something about allowing fish to meet. You know, this summer there'll be millions of chum in the river. Or not millions, maybe one or a few million to, you know, sustain our way of life in on that part. But then you said we will allow, you know, fish. And I don't know where you're allowing this fish come by, the Area M or the trawlers or what, where this allow word came from to allow us just a little bit of fish. So anyway, that was what I have to say there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Krishna. I know there's some interest in the Koyukuk to do some streamside incubation boxes. That's not a large-scale production hatchery. That's basically a system that's designed to try to involve the public in trying to restore hatcheries into the system. And there's a lot of value in having communities be invested in trying to rebuild their stocks. And to the extent that they come forward with a permit to put a streamside egg incubation box in the Koyukuk drainage, and that involves those members of the community and the tribal members to participate in rebuilding, I'm all for that. We're going to do it under permitting of the state, so we're going to make sure it's done right and it's not causing long-term harm. But getting people, whether it's harvesting fish in a culture camp, whether it's getting people to get their hands on some fish and putting them in egg incubation boxes, maintaining that hands-on with fish is important as we get through rebuilding.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. This is Gail Vick again. I guess my only question on that, on the streamside incubation, is that the current bill that's in the House, HB 169, allows for up to 50,000 per minute of eggs. I'm sorry, thank you, 500,000. Thank you, Jim. The problem is, in order to get those eggs out of Chinook, and we're not taking any fish out of the river, you have to have 150 to 200 females, twice as many males, to propagate that number of eggs and not even get a one-to-one return on it. That's the concern.
I'm talking about under the existing incubation permitting system that I have, and that's a much smaller one. But I understand that the current version of the bill that Representative Cronk has introduced would still require ADF&G permitting. And in no system are we going to allow 150 females being taken out of a system for egg permit to basically, when there's only like 200 fish in the system. So still requires ADF&G permitting.
Okay, today happens to be Senator Sullivan formed what he called a task force of people to try to figure out what science needs to be done to figure out why fish aren't coming back anymore to the AYK region. But I just spent 12 days at the meeting in Anchorage for Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet's chums, coho, and kings are just in as bad a shape as ours are. Cook Inlets are. Same thing. But anyway, a couple of us in the room, right here, and Caroline, wherever she went, back in the very back, we're in this group that Senator Sullivan formed. And today was the deadline for all our comments to be finalized. So I just reread that thing before I came to this meeting and made my little piddly comment that I made. But I want to point out what the majority, or what we all voted on. And when I say voted on, the task force, or the task force is the people appointed, and then they have a AYK working group. And the AYK working group is what Charlie and I are on. Caroline is in the task force part. Anyway, and so the thing that we wanted, that needed the most science, was number one, the impact caused by Hatchery, Pink, and Chum, and the whole gob of Bristol Bay sockeye return. That was the number one thing. The number two thing was the bycatch in the marine environment. And when I say that's bycatch and intercept fisheries both combined is what it was. But today was the deadline, and so they're going to finish our two co-chairs, which one of them is from the department, Dr. Katie Howard, and the other one is Dr. Daniel Schindler from the University of Washington. They'll be getting this thing finished tomorrow, or they say they are. It's a lot of work to do because that thing's 20-something typed pages. But anyway, they're supposed to get it submitted tomorrow to the task force, so that, which is kind of run by NOAA, and Ed Farley, the guy that's the director for the Alaska Science Center for NOAA, he's the co-chair of that, and then supposedly we should get a bunch of money for more science, and this is supposed to figure out what science to do, and so we'll see what happens with that. But the commissioner said we hadn't got any money for the Yukon River panel for 10 or 12 years. It's actually a total of 22 years, because I've been on the panel, or the negotiating thing of that, and then the panel since 1988, which is a long time, and we actually signed the agreement in 2002. We agreed to it in 2001 after the big failure of Kings and Trumps both in 2000. Then we agreed to it the very next April. But that's what I wanted to say, and so I don't know if that'll give hope to some people, but it gives me some hope. Maybe we'll get something done, I hope.
Thanks, Virgil.
So one of the things that when I became commissioner 6 years ago, I thought we were doing a fairly good job of figuring out what's happened in the fish and rivers. Rivers are relatively small compared to the ocean, but we have sonars, we have juvenile programs, we have creel surveys, we have fish tickets. We do a really good job of figuring out what's happening to these fish in the river, but we have no idea what's happening to them once they hit the ocean. So we put together a marine science program. Dr. Katie Howard, I think most of you may know her, is actually starting to unravel the pieces of what's happening to these salmon after they head out to sea. And she's starting to unravel what's happening in that first month and a half out at sea. She's got some really good research over the last 5 or 6 years now on Chinook salmon, starting to be able to predict what's happening based on what they face in that first month and a half out at sea. She's starting to piece it together now with chum salmon. And we're moving that program now into the southern Bering Sea in the Bristol Bay area, as well as into the Gulf of Alaska and Southeast Alaska. So we're starting to get a better handle on that. That's going to start answering questions like food, competition out in the ocean, a variety of other things. We also participated in the International Year of the Salmon when that was going on. I think it was 2 years ago. We put people on the ships. We actually participated in collecting that information. It has some really interesting data. You would think if Chinook salmon and pink salmon are really competing that much that they'd be occupying the same space out in the ocean. That's not what was found out in the Bering Sea surveys. It's kind of really confounding to a lot of different people. Chinook salmon are, you know, they're all cold-blooded. When the ocean warms up, it takes a little bit more energy demand. Food sources aren't the right food sources because of changing climate that may or not be related to food competition. You know, they basically are on a less nutritious diet. They have higher energy demand. You're going to lose weight. You come back smaller at age, and you come back, you know, earlier than you typically came back. And that's what we're kind of seeing coast-wide. You know, we're seeing Chinook salmon come back younger at age and smaller at age. So it's we're piecing it together, but it's not an easy picture when you get out in the middle of the ocean, especially some of these food competition studies. And right now, most of the food competition studies are based on correlative data. Basically, it says, if this is happening, we also see this happening. Well, you know, right now, I could show that the stock market's increasing because CO2 is increasing. I don't think anybody make that as a positive proof that CO2 is causing your 402, 401C plan to increase. So we need some real data. We need some real data out in the ocean, and NIMS is starting to piece those things together.
Yeah, if I just might add to that, Senator Murkowski has been incredibly supportive. We found out a week ago that we were able to secure some federal dollars, some earmarks, now that they're back in the system. Who knew? And with that, we got $2 million to do salmon health research. A lot of that will be focused on the Yukon, and I imagine other areas where we're seeing issues, but the Yukon is hopefully not the harbinger for all other rivers, but we do know that there's some critical problems. I know, you know, between ichthyophonus, tapeworms at the mouth, pre-spawning mortality. I've also heard reports of people seeing fish with clear eggs as far as eagle in the river. So we'll be doing a lot more research on that. We got $2 million for salmon critical stocks, research and enhancement. I'm not at liberty at this point in time to disclose details because we just found out about this money. A lot of that will be focused on the Yukon as well. We'll be taking a hard look at what comes out of that task force report and look at the critical uncertainties and hopefully direct some more funding towards getting at some of that. We were also successful in getting $1.2 million, thanks to the efforts of Senator Murkowski as well, for those vessel surveys in the Bering Sea, and another chunk of change to do vessel upgrades to our survey vessels that we do have. So a lot of support there and for some juvenile salmon work. So we have lots more to look forward to in terms of research. And I do want to thank the folks in this room who've been part of that task force effort. I know it's been a lot of extra work, but hopefully it'll yield some good fruits.
All right, back here.
Hi, Commissioner Lang, Olivia Irwin with Mentone Nana again. I just wanted to touch on two responses that you had. One was to Tommy Kriska's saying that you would be encouraging of passing permits for incubation on the river. And then in response to Eva Burke's comments, you were speaking about needing more data and making efforts towards receiving local knowledge from fishermen and including data. So since you're happy to provide permits and you need more data, I'm wondering if you will be in support of Tanana Chiefs Conference Mid-River Sonar.
So we have been trying to work with Tanana Chiefs. We don't have the capacity to put this on in ourselves. So the money went to Tanana Chiefs. So I understand finding a location for a sonar is challenging, is number one. So I know there's been a lot of work going on, cooperating with our staff and trying to find the right location. I think we brought staff from Tanana Chiefs down to our pilot station sonar to learn how to run that. And we're committed to continuing that partnership moving forward. I can tell you one of the challenges with that mid-river sonar is finding the locations that best answers the questions facing the river. And then there's the question of what do you do about apportionment? So you got a beam going across the river and you know it's counting fish, but are they counting kings or are they counting fall chums? Are they counting summer chums? What are they counting going past that sonar beam? That requires a net in the river. And I can tell you there's a lot of angst about an additional mortality of a couple hundred Chinook salmon to estimate the apportionment going past that river system. So I think some new technologies are developing like tangle nets and a variety of other things that you can aim to reduce that. But running that sonar so that the benefits outweigh the take of fish in that river is going to be a challenge moving forward. But again, we're there. We will provide that help, but you know those challenges are real, especially with the Canadian perspective. On, you know, 40% of those snook salmon that are taken, probably more than that, probably closer to half of them at Tanana that are running past that sonar beam are Canadian origin fish. And if you're taking 400 or 500 of them for apportionment, that gets on the radar screen pretty quickly.
All right, we're going to move to online Melissa Johnson.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, good evening. My name is Melissa Johnson. I work for the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Tribal Consortium as the Government Affairs Policy Director. In regards to, one, thank you for providing this opportunity in a hybrid opportunity this evening. In the agreement under the first question that I had in regards to item number 4, recognizing the importance of Chinook salmon for ceremonial use and the transmission of cultural knowledge, the parties may, at their discretion, provide limited harvest opportunity for these purposes. The question that I have is it going to be a set time of year? So, like, say, only on July 10th is the only opportunity for this limited harvest to practice your indigenous way of life. The next that I had regarding number 7, and I will not read it, but working on traditional and local ecological knowledge research, is there going to be a joint effort incorporating ADFNG and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, their LKTKS task force, and also maybe interacting on the Canadian side? And then the third question that I had regarding number 9, reducing marine patches and bycatches of Yukon River origin salmon to the extent practical is, why is the burden of conservation only placed within the in-river system, and it's not shared, on the marine, the sea portion all the way through? I don't see equity in item number 9. Thank you.
Okay, so number 4. I think the agreement basically says that there's an importance to doing this. I don't think you want the state telling you on which date to go do that. I think we're going to work with communities up and down the river to figure out how best to do that, so that you're the experts on your cultures and your traditions and how you would like to do that. The state will get itself involved in the extent of what those harvests are, but how you do that, you're going to have a critical voice in that moving forward. Number 7, how we're going to bring traditional ecological knowledge into it. I know the Board of Fish now has an opportunity between public comment and before the committee as a whole to bring in people that have traditional ecological knowledge to share with the board. They've done that now at 2 different board meetings. That's been very informative to the board. I've learned quite a bit, and I think they're going to continue that. And I know they're going to be talking to the board again about whether they want to do that at the board meetings, at their joint board meeting moving forward. Number 9, or number 10, I think, was what's the relative importance of these different fisheries, and how you brought up the word to the extent practical. The word extent practical is the stuff that's in the treaty right now, those same terminologies. And it's embedded in the Magnus and Stevens. See, zero bycatch is not something that's practical under Magnus and Stevens. That said, we are going to move forward with restricting those catches. And again, we took the Area M bycatch of chum salmon down from 1.2 million down to 200,000, which when you turn those into AYK fish, chum salmon, that's about 40,000 AYK chum salmon. So we took a big hit in that. And that wasn't at any cost. That probably was at a significant cost to those fishermen of harvesting 2 or 3 million Bristol Bay sockeye, which is a pretty big hit to those local communities that live up and down that area. It also came at an expense in the Nooshiak drainage, because I wasn't able to harvest those 2 or 3 million sockeye in Area M. Now we had to wait to harvest them in Bristol Bay, and most of those were Nooshiak orange and sockeye salmon, and we fished hard out in front of the Nooshiak when we had king salmon conservation concerns in the Nooshiak. So there's a lot of different factors playing in and out there. And then we took chums. One other thing, with Chum Salmon, we are doing everything we can to try to figure out the genetic composition of Chum Salmon right now. Our genetics lab in the National Marine Fisheries Service genetics lab is trying to piece together what a difference is between a Yukon, a Kuskokwim, a Bristol Bay, and a Norton Sound Chum Salmon is. We're not there yet. We are trying our best, but if we could start unraveling that, we would have a lot better information on how to manage those fisheries moving forward. And in terms of Chinook salmon out in the Bering Sea, again, we're down to 6,000 Chinook salmon, and those are sub-adult Chinook salmon. By the time you turn those into adults, and you factor those out into the systems, it's not a lot. So, and again, that came at a significant cost to that trawl industry in terms of where they were fishing. So, yeah, is it zero? No, but under Magnuson, it's not practical to get to zero, but that doesn't mean we're not taking steps to reduce it.
Next, we're going to go to Sven Falken.
All right, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. Hello, my name is Sven Falken. I'm the tribal administrator for the Ohlakcha tribe here in St. Mary's on the Lower Yukon. I have with me here listening in two of my council members, Peter Tyson and Isaac Prince. One of our previous council meetings, I presented the agreement that was presented at the last panel meeting in January, and I gotta tell you there was some changes made from the original document that was received to one to what we're seeing here. And the original document didn't even have paragraph 9 in there, and that's the one thing that was, I think, brought up at the panel meeting. There's no really nothing the original document had dealing as far as the marine environment fisheries, because everything is, what I've seen, is geared towards subsistence fishing on the main river here. So I'm not sure that's going to go, and I kind of share the feeling from the previous lady before me, I forget her name, regarding that the big issue we have, at least here at the village level, and I've heard from other folks, is we've been closed for 12 years, commercial subsistence chinook fishing, I think it is, something like that. So we're almost at two life cycles, and still we're not seeing any kind of real increase in the stocks. But the big heartburn people ought to have out here is the continued fishing in Area M and the high seas, the bycatch issue. I know the state and the feds had a chance to do something about last summer's meetings, but there was no action taken on it. So that's just one concern I have. I've been hearing is how that's allowed to happen, where one set of people can't fish, and then here we got the other fishermen that are actually throwing fish overboard. That's a big heartburn for a lot of people on the river. The second question I had here is, as far as this implementation of Annex 4, Chapter 8 for 2024 to 2030, if this is going to be applied on the U.S. side as a management decision, how does that work out as far as the public process goes? I know there's a process that goes on for any kind of management decisions that has to go through the Board of Fish, but I don't see this happening right now. If that's the case, I mean, the process, there is a process involved for making management decisions, and this can't just be done unilaterally like what I'm seeing here. It is. Maybe someone can explain that to me. Thank you.
Well, the Board of Fish has to abide by international treaty obligations. So the extent that we're entering it as agreement to a category that's Pacific Salmon Treaty, they basically have to abide by that. Now, that said, they have a lot of flexibility in deciding how they're going. Like if you get to find a new gear type that allows the minimization of catches of fish of a Chinook salmon while prosecuting the Chum salmon fishery, they could do that. So we left it vague enough that the Board of Fish has the authority to continue to try to manage within the constraints of minimizing Canadian origin Chinook salmon in that river system. But they, under the terms of this agreement, they would have to try to meet 71,000 past the border in terms of how they're managing the river.
Can you hear me?
Can.
Oh, okay. I guess that brings up my additional questions, hearing your answer there. if we're not able to make the current escapement between 42.5 and, what is it, 5200 or something like that, how are we expected to reach a rebuilding target of 71,000 when we haven't seen any increase for the last, what, 12 years on our part, giving up the fisheries here on the river?
So what do you want to get to? Do you want to get to minimum escapement goals with that rebuild stocks, or do you want to get back to a rebuild stock that provides both subsistence opportunities and opportunities for people to harvest these fish, knowing the importance of the economic value of commercially harvesting these fish as to people in the forward?
Well, looking down the road, trying to sell the stocks, we haven't even reached that over the last so many years. It's going to take a miracle just to, I think, break even this year as far as escapement goes. I mean, the report, from what I've seen, the preseason reports are predicting lesser amounts of returns as well this year. So is this going to continue on? This 7-year agreement is going to become a 14-year, 21-year? That's a concern I have, and I don't think enough is being done to address the fisheries out in the marine environment. We're not the problem on the river. We haven't fished for 12 years or so, and I know the First Nations up in Canada haven't fished for longer than that, and still we're not seeing any kind of great returns. So that's a concern I have. I mean, there's no other options. I mean, what are we looking at in the future if this doesn't work out?
Thank you, sir, for your comments. I'm glad you were able to join from St. Mary's. I'm going to turn it over to Eva.
Well, thank you. I think that gentleman had a very good point, that we're living on a prayer, that one thing that we've never tried is a moratorium or a 7-year decree out in the ocean. And I think that's something that we really need to talk about, because I feel like for a lot of people in here to say, let's collect more data. We can spend an eternity collecting data, but unless we take action, nothing's going to change. And unfortunately, when people are not able to feed themselves and we have all of our vessels shut down on the river, we're expecting to see some vessels shut down in the ocean, whether they like it or not. You cannot prioritize money over culture. That's the trade-off that's being made at Board of Fish and that North Pacific, and at some point it's going to come to a head. Those sockeye that you're talking about that people are chasing, I don't even think you can sell the sockeye. It might have been my understanding that sockeye has been in the freezer for 2 winters now. That doesn't have a market. So I think you're over-harvesting the sockeye, and you don't have a market for it, and then you're hurting the chums. And it's really important to understand what's happening there, because there is not 100% observer coverage on those vessels in Area M. So the accuracy of the bycatch, a lot of people here do not have any confidence in that accuracy, and there was violations of chum chucking last year in Area M. So I really want to emphasize what that guy says. We are living on the prayer. We are doing everything. We have done everything that we can. And until something happens in that ocean, sir, we're not going to get anywhere. So I really, really encourage us to continue to have a lot of conversation to really get to the solutions that people are asking for. And I think in a very timely fashion. I don't think we have another 5 to 10 years to wait for data collection. Thanks.
Well, our time's getting low. I just wanted to double check any other advisory committee members who didn't get a chance to ask a question or make a comment. And in that case, we'll turn it over to members of the public, starting with you, Jim.
Thank you for the opportunity. Of course, as you know, I have a million questions, but I'm going to try to keep focus. And it's sort of off somewhat. My first question is somewhat off the topic of this decree or agreement. But I'm very concerned about the discussions of prosecuting a commercial summer chum salmon fishery. I've even heard it from the federal in-season manager, who has no authority whatsoever in managing commercial fishing. So I'd like your staff to clarify what the range of uncertainty is around the point estimate of a million, I think, as you said. And then I'd also like to hear what data exists on the Chinook mortality from the incidental catch, because we have all seen the videos of these dip nets put on long ropes and then come in and the fish are being beaten against the side of the boat and there's blood coming out of the fish on these videos. And so how many Chinook salmon will you kill if you open a dip net commercial chum salmon fishery? That's my first question. My second question is, given the excellent work by your, and I want to thank you for establishing the Marine Salmon Ecology Program, and you've got an excellent team there with Dr. Katie Howard and Sabrina Garcia, et cetera. And I'm very concerned, and we've already spoken about this, Doug, somewhat, of permitting streamside incubation for Chinook salmon when we know that as soon as they get to the near shore, there's not proper nutrition. So how will that really help our naturally born and hatched wild salmon? I mean, we also have experts in the room, you know, that speak about the negative impacts of enhanced fish on wild stock. And so those are my two big questions that I have for you. Thank you.
I don't think they're enhanced fish, as you call them. They're basically naturally produced fish in an incubation box streamside. That's a lot different than what I would consider an enhanced fish that's basically a hatchery broodstock that is continually pumped into a system affecting genetics and a variety of other things. So, again, to me, it's small scale and it involves the people that are culturally tied to these resources doing it in the future. It's small scale. Now, I do share your concern a little bit as that becomes bigger scale, and I think, again, some of those pieces of legislation out there really do tie back to the size of the operation, but the department could still do that. I think the big question that we have an unknown on is what's happening in Russia right now. We really have no idea what happens with bycatch in the Russian trawl fishery. I disagree with you. In the trawl fishery, we do have good counts of Chinook salmon in that trawl fishery. It's 100% observed. That's an intercept fishery in my mind. But in the trawl fishery, we do. Yeah. But I was kind of mixing the two here. So I just want to make sure that we are working our best to try to get a better answer on what's happening in bycatch in that Russian trawl fishery. It's hard to believe that we catch Chinook salmon outside of the border, but immediately across that little mysterious line in the ocean, there's zero on that side of the order. We know that's not true. So, what was your other question, Jim? Oh, chum, okay. Yeah. So that's a balance. So clearly, when I went up and down the river, I heard two different things. I said, people said, we got to have this chum salmon for food. We also need to have some economic opportunities associated with chum salmon because we can't live on just food alone. We need money to run our gas for the boat. We need money to buy products and to go fishing and all these other things. So we're trying to figure out how we can provide that local commercial opportunity for chum salmon, but in a way that minimizes Chinook salmon. We're going to be very carefully balancing that, especially at the lower levels of Chinook salmon in that river right now. So if we start seeing high rates of mortality of Chinook salmon, we're going to crank back on commercial opportunity, the subsistence opportunities first. But clearly, there's a cash economy that's dependent upon in these communities of having some cash coming in, and that right now is some level of commercial fishing.
Being killed, but if you're opening a commercial dip net fishery and beating the hell out of Canadian origin Chinook salmon so that people can make money, then there should be no resistance to issuing the permit that has been on your desk for about a month to for that mid-river sonar. So that is the basis of my question. The permit has been submitted quite some time ago. I don't know the particular date.
We have someone online. No, thank you.
All right, Alyssa Nadine Rogers, you're ready to go.
Alyssa, can you hear us? We're unable to hear you.
Looks like you just need to unmute one more time, Alyssa.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and give it to Rob back here.
Yeah, thanks, Doug, for coming. My name's Rod Arno. My daughter hasn't had a fresh cane off the drainage as she's lived on for a couple decades to eat. But my question to you is that we've got 2 decades of peer-reviewed data on the negative effect on wild salmon by hatchery fish. 2 decades of peer-reviewed data. And that's something that the state can do something about, is state hatcheries. Well, we can't do anything about the Russians. We can't do anything about the Chinese. We can do something in Alaskan waters about those hatcheries. Just holding it at the cap that it's been the whole time that you've been in your position here for the last 6 years isn't enough. Reducing it is very important to not only these folks, but to my family.
Okay.
All right, looks like we've got Victor Lord back on the phone. And Victor, you're going to have to press *6 to unmute on the phone.
Yeah, perfect.
We can hear you
again. Okay, thank you. I just wanted to point out that I believe you know, I really appreciate Bukowski for what you've done, but I think Senator Sullivan is on some kind of Commerce Committee, and I thought the Commerce Committee issues out money to the feds like NOAA and all them for whatever studies in the ocean maybe. Would that be the direction to go? And, cause I always believe that the ocean was the most most quiet information that we did not know. The river system's been studied pretty good. I know most of the biologists there. There are workers. Even if they could get some money and push toward Katie Howard, Dr. Katie Howard. One last thing, I'm forgetting what I wanted to tell you guys. Okay. Anyway, this is turning out pretty good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm a bestie.
Thank you, Mr. Lord. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and pass it around. I'm sorry, I saw my name back here first. I'm going to give it to Dave.
Thank you, Commissioner. A little different address here. This ichthyophthalmus, this disease that they're picking up in the marine environment, can anybody here speak a little bit about that and what it's causing and a little bit about the in-river mortality from that particular parasite?
I just try to talk just very generally about ichthys. So we think it's the disease. We think the Chinook salmon are picking up in the ocean from the food that they eat. So they're coming into the river with an infection. We've been sampling for ichthyophthalmus the last couple of years at various points in the river. So last year we sampled kings from pilot station, from the sonar operation, from up near the rapids near Tanana and at Fort Yukon. And what we're thinking is that fish are coming into the river infected, and then that as they progress upriver, as they migrate, they're not eating, they're undergoing a lot of stress. We're thinking that there may be they may be perishing from ichthyophonus. This is a hypothesis that we're working on exploring. So they're looking at disease presence and then also severity, and trying to see if they can tease out if that is a cause of mortality or a contributing cause to mortality, Chinook salmon or migrating upstream. There's also a radio tagging project going on where they're tagging fish in mnemonic, Chinook salmon, and then they got radio towers so they can see where those fish are going. They're also doing individual assignments, so they're collecting genetics from every fish that they tag. So they'll know, for instance, that tag number 37 is in the Canadian origin fish, and then they'll see, does that fish make it to Canada, or does it drop out somewhere along the river? So there's a lot of unknowns around ichthyophonus, but there's a lot of really good work being done to try to understand when and where Chinook salmon get it and how it may be affecting their success in migration.
Don Duncan. I got some quick questions. I've been a sport fishing guide here for 40-some years, South Chinchina Kings, been out of business for years, on that end of things. Did the sportsman cause any of these problems? You can just nod your head yes or no. The South Chinchina are the two biggest king salmon spawning grounds on the Yukon that are in Alaska. I don't think sportsman caused any problem. Who is it? Everybody keeps saying there's been a 40-year deal against hatcheries. We can put 30 million red salmon in the Gulf, but we can't stock one king. Now you're saying that we can't afford to take any eggs from a king because they're so precious now. Seems to me like we waited way too long to start trying a hatchery production, you know, helping through stocking. And to your point, Gail, you made the comments that I've heard forever. Only 1 to 2% make it back. How many of them make it down? Now, they may get hatched. They may never see salt water. And the reason I bring this up is Mike Dossie, Fishing Game, years ago told me, he said, I said, why is there only 30 kings going past the bridge at Olden's Pond, just north of town here, 10 miles? Only 30. And we still got a sport fishing season. I said, why only 30? He said, well, they're in a predator pit. If you're a salmon fry and you've got to go down to Chattanooga, down to Tolovana, down through Mento Flats, chances are you're not going to make it to the Panama. So they're in a predator pit, which brings me back to how many are making it downriver? Is there any study? I've never heard of one, and I'm curious, because I have fished along the Yukon. Now, fish for pike at the mouth of every river. And that's where you catch all kind of pike. And if those salmon fry are holed up taking a break at those river mouths, you're going to get some heavy predation right there. And I've seen it on the Nooshiegak. And I'm very familiar with the Nooshiegak and the destruction of the king's down there. Not destruction, but you know how the king run has gone down there. I sport this guy down there, too. And I've watched the reds explode and the kings dwindle. So I've watched the pike slash salmon fry in that river. They don't even move. They just lay along the bank and they reach out and grab a mouthful every 2 or 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to try one more time for Alyssa. Oh, sorry.
It's juvenile work. I think that's a very important question to start answering. It's hard work to do. You know, we've done juvenile work in a couple of different systems. We got it kind of nailed down in Southeast Alaska now, but it requires putting a lot of coated water tags in those fish and then trying to figure out what's happening in the marine environment with those coated water tags to get ocean survival rates. We got some money now through the federal earmarks to look at juvenile work. I think we're probably not going to start that work in the Yukon. I think we're probably going to look at another stock of concern we have, which is the Kenai, where we have a lot of new technology that may start unraveling that question. But clearly, in the Kenai River, you know, you got to wonder whether we're putting so many fish in, whether they're dying as juveniles going out or during their overwintering periods of time, or they're really just having bad ocean survival. We're going to start piecing those puzzles together. I think you're hearing a wide debate on issues regarding hatcheries in this river system. So I encourage you to get on the Yukon panel and encourage you to
involve yourself in the rebuilding plan that they're going to be putting together, one of which is going to be a hatchery discussion. So what they did at the Whitehorse Hatchery is they have a raceway that goes up past the hatchery, past the dam. They take fish out of that raceway, they rear them, and then they take the reared fish and they put them into a single tributary above the dam. Well, it's a mixture of about 50 or 60 different stocks that go up that raceway, and now you're diluting that single stock in that tributary with a whole wide range of those mixtures of stocks. Now, if they released all those fish back into below the raceway, that would be a different issue. But the way they have that designed is not well designed in terms of preserving genetic integrity moving forward. No. It's just the way they're running that hatchery.
Okay, we're going to try Alyssa Nadine Rogers one last time. So, Alyssa, you just need to unmute. All right, that's not working.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment publicly, just as a public. My name is Carrie Stevens, and I have fished in 5D for a few decades, a couple of salmon life cycles. And I want to echo everything that's been said in this room. And while we all very much applaud, you see the first people to stand down on the moratorium are the tribes. The Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission stood down on their own in 2014. Yet Area M refuses to stand down. Trawling has taken millions of tons cumulatively over decades. And you heard, I just want to echo those sentiments in this room. You know people are frustrated. The vast majority of the years that I have been on the Yukon, we have not fished. That is a plain, simple truth. Now, people need to make money. The one few things I wanted to add to the record, Commissioner, the pollock industry is wholly subsidized by the U.S. government, and the USDA spends millions of dollars annually to buy pollock and to buy salmon from the oceans. Our own government. Alaska's priority, your priority, is subsistence. It is less than 1% of the overall take of all fish and game in this state. So I understand people need to make money. But your priority is that people need to eat. And people are upset. And I really wanted to add the USDA buyouts to the record. I appreciate this opportunity to do that. And you see my heart and my passion on the floor. When we should have been fishing, we buried 5 to 6 people between 2 villages. Traditional fishermen. With nowhere left to go but bottle. And I'm sorry that I get torn up. But this is what we would like answers for. We have not fished. You heard it from St. Mary's to Eagle. It's not bringing the fish back. We have to ask ourselves. I finally woke up to this being 5D gal myself. Why don't the fish want to go back to Canada? You keep talking about the White Horse Dam. We act like we have the best habitat. You are looking at tribal people that are fighting on every front to protect that watershed and to stand down. And the ignorant, simple truth that we're missing in this room is that every single place that salmon have come back in the United States, tribes have done that. And my question to you is, why are you afraid to let tribes leave?
They want to. They want to conserve. Listen to them. They want to lead. In every single place you look where there were no salmon and there are salmon now, it is tribes. And that dam needs to go, and you know First Nations agree. And First Nations are speaking up about mining in the headwaters. We look at, talk about transboundary mining all over Southeast. What about the Yukon? Those fish haven't wanted to go back for decades in 5D. We don't get chum. We get very minimal fall chum up there. And they did not cause this crisis. And they have stood down. So Board of Fish, I really appreciate that they're not here because Area M and the Magnificent Seven was assault on many people were traumatized by the comments made in that room. And so I just wanted to bring the humility, the humanness to burying people, that is not in vain and that this is not a solution. This is a false solution. We need to stand against the government subsidizing the pollock industry. Jim Balsiger retires from NOAA and says, oh, we took 30 billion tons, metric tons of life out of Bering Sea. We all know there's nothing left. So I just really wanted to put that on record, but I would love to know, why can't tribes lead? What's wrong with the sonar? They have solutions. Please go to them. Don't put it on them to invite the Board of Fish out. They don't have money to do that. So where is their natural resource funding to do so? They have no money. It goes to the state. And people are making their whole careers on research wonderful and fighting for salmon. And the people in the village have nothing. You've been there, Doug. You know they have nothing. So I wanted to put those comments on record, and you have no idea how much I appreciate the opportunity to do so. And I hope we can have real conversations about the entire ecosystem. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
All right, one more time for Alyssa with the Bethel Oishi.
Okay, Alyssa.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now.
Perfect. Sorry about that technical difficulty. I'm out in Bethel, and we're about to be approaching a storm. We have one right on our coast, so might be causing me issues. But thank you so much for calling me. Thank you for giving me the time. Sorry about the technical difficulties. Am I good to go?
Go ahead, Alyssa.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I want to thank the board and board staff that are currently there. You guys work endlessly, and it's a thankless job, so I want to thank you all so much for everything that you do. Trust me, I understand. My family's from Alhanak and Hooper Bay. We live on the coast, and I'm Alice and John Hansen's granddaughter. My mom is Marita Hansen. I'm Ella Bridget Hill Joseph and Kilrin Sarah Lincoln Fred Joseph. My dad is Alan Joseph. I was 5 years for the YK Subsistence Regional, Federal Subsistence Regional Council Chair, and I just was reappointed as Vice Chair for this year. I also was Madam Chair for AVAC and also the co-chair for the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group, Madam Secretary of Alaska State Fish and AC, and then also Future Nations Futures Leadership through Stanford University. I also co-founded the No Donlin Gold Working Group, co-founded the YK Rio Alliance, co-founded the Chilista Working Group. I'm also ambassador for NOAA and Alaska Youth Delegate. A member of the Alaska Community Action on Toxins, Alaska Derelict Vessel Toxins. I'm also a member on the AFN Census Committee and also a member of the LEO Network. So according to the civil knowledge of people who live every day on these rivers can tell you more knowledge than what your science can provide for you. And you need to hear them out. Let them talk. We understand that this meeting is being held to be a conversation between the two, but I want to hear from the people. I want to hear what they have to say. They have things that need to be said and more minimal on the board side. You got to let these people talk. We understand there's science, there's research, there's information. Tell them where to go for this information, but let the people talk. There is no way either federal or state fisheries management will be able to stop Alaskan residents from harvesting salmon. You take my fish, you take my life. Do you know how hard it is to change people's mentality over the years? Availability to fish to the mindset of conservation. I'm sorry. But you have to be, I was shot at. My crew was shot at. We were shot at when we go to fish camps to collect information. I was working for a tribal organization. Yet they thought I was fishing game or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they were worried that we were going to go there to take their fish, but yet we were just collecting our daily information from them. Fishing for King Salmon Conservation. And then my house being broken into, my vehicles being vandalized. It takes money to pay for these things. Yet I'm still here advocating and pushing for the rights of subsistence to be heard. The reality of subsistence salmon food is the life of all the people you are looking at in that room and the people that are on the phone. I bet you, even you eat salmon at $120 per fillet. Out here in Bethel, it's $246.99. I just went to the store today. That's ridiculous. There is a substantial evidence of AYK interception dating back to the early 1930s and 1940s by the first Alaskan U.S. Fish and Wildlife researcher, who was a biologist and mentioned that protecting these fisheries as he feared as his theory was going to come into reality. And look at us now. We are living his theory of fear. Subsistence is a priority. Our food security is the number one topic at the capital, at this moment. As for Canada, they want to put us under endangered species status. But they won't help to push to close the intercept fisheries. All the intercept fisheries that are targeting AYK fish. And then on top of it, who's the biggest buyer of them all? They need to pull out of the commercial fishery that they are isolating the take of king salmon that are headed for AYK. Our fishermen have always been the first and the last to be heavily restricted. The treaty needs to be fair on protecting salmon and salmon habitat and equal fishermen rights. No mining. Redirection of historical spawning grounds has been detrimental, and even the Canadian locals have been advocating and fighting for these salmon rights to be done on their lands with no governmental support or advocating to protect our fishery at all. And you want to talk about a cash economy? Yes, there's a cash economy. But the person that's giving us the money is from Canada. So in closing, one, close the intercept fishery. Two, shut down Canadian mining. Three, have Canadians stay out of Alaska's mining and trying to get into our resources. No mining in Alaska. Four, food security. subsistence is a priority out here for us to have our livelihood and to live and to survive and feed our children. You don't know what it's like to starve. I starved when I was a child. I know what it's like. Going to bed hungry, waking up in the morning, getting my stuff on, going to school. Don't make my kids and their kids feel the same thing. No Canadian commercial fishery. They have a commercial fishery. If everyone's going to feel the burden, stop it. Fix protection of the donut hole. We need some kind of enforcement to protect our fish who are going out there, who are staying out there from 7 to 12 years old. Those are our big fisheries out there. You really want to be serious about protecting our fisheries? Protect what we need the most. I haven't commercial fished on the Yukon in 20 years. 20 years. It's been 20 years since I last fished out there. Thank you.
Alyssa, thank you for your comments. All right, thank you.
All right, next we'll go to Brooke Woods as our final speaker. Brooke, you can go ahead and unmute and begin speaking.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you, Brooke.
I was not planning on attending, but it's such an important issue and time to make decisions that support tribes and salmon. Doug Vincent Lang, in a recent publication, public records show that you made some insensitive comments about dreaming about chum and king hatcheries on the Yukon. And that just did not align with what was said on the stage at the Ten and the Chiefs Conference convention. The other thing is, I really encourage understanding what a sovereign tribe and the governance structure is. You know, these advisory councils, that is not co-management. And, you know, our tribes, we have the right to sovereignty. We have the right to our traditional ways of life. Even if the federal and state subsistence laws do not really recognize the true hunting and fishing livelihoods that we depend on. I'm in Juneau, and there's just so much happening that you can be supporting. I do not support this agreement. It violates tribal sovereignty. It circumvents all management processes for us to engage as tribal citizens, public citizens, and those, you know, if me or the federal government created an agreement without you, Doug Vincent Lang, I can guarantee that you would sue me for doing such a thing, just like the state sued the Federal Subsistence Board for providing an emergency hunt during a global pandemic. And when you look at that hunt that was granted, it was such a beautiful thing to have a few animals taken that was provided very nutritional food to a whole community. I wanted to put on record, you know, the solutions. You know, our tribes are so organized. We care about our salmon. We are doing so much to ensure that our salmon are protected in the Bering Sea and as they make their way to us. They come back to the river to give life to our tribes and to produce the next generation of salmon. You know, we have this relationship with our salmon for a reason. You keep saying that there's a process. Get engaged. You know, when you look at the Board of Fish for Area M, the comment period was extended 2 days. You know, we had hundreds of people supporting the proposals to reduce fishing time in Area M. What was the turnout? I think a 12% reduction of time when we were requesting 60%. So that process doesn't work. We have one subsistence voting member and then one Alaska Native member. And again, you know, the vote is just not there to support these very important critical efforts to save our salmon. And then you look at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I mean, we are, again, organized and such intelligent elders, tribal members, tribal organizations showing up, testifying, requesting bycatch reduction, nothing. You have the pollock sector dominating those votes. That decision, I'm guessing they go there with the decision made already, despite, you know, hundreds of written comments, hundreds of testimony. So again, very organized with no action. You have the lawsuit, with Earth Justice, ADCP, TCC. You have the, House Bill 128 to reduce temporarily closed Area M. We've had tribal consultation with the federal agencies. You have the EIS for CHUM, and when you look at the data, it really shows the high volume of bycatch near the mouth of the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. So we can't keep saying, you know, it doesn't matter what bycatch looks like, it's all Asian hatchery. It's just not reflecting that anymore. You have the Alaska Salmon Task Force. We have identified marine harvest as a top priority. I am a part of the working group. You also have the Bycatch Advisory Council. And again, I'm just reiterating things that are happening that you can support as the commissioner. The last that I would like to share is, you know, you have the emergency petition for zero bycatch of Chinook. And, you know, the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, the national standards, the guideline for national standards 4, 8, and 9, you know, that's also being considered for amendment. So you have all of these efforts happening right now trying to do the same thing. And you really need to align with the request. And this agreement is not the solution. We know that. When you look at the last 4 years, we've been completely shut down. Has it improved the run? No. Has it improved escapement? No. It's actually hurting the run. It's hurting the escapement. So it's not the solution. And you're not building trust. You're not developing a government-to-government relationship. And we are at such a critical time with our king salmon and our chum. You need to take action, and this agreement is not the solution. And I just wanted to put on record, you know, there's these very important efforts happening right now around both CHUM and King that you can be supporting rather than just shutting down tribes and walking away. I appreciate this. You know, I did not want to spend my evening here, but I am. I really care, and I just appreciate the time. And, you know, if you support tribes and these other efforts, you may meet the subsistence priority in your time as the commissioner, because it just has not happened, you know, in the last 4 years for the Yukon and other drainages within the Yukon. And again, you know, we don't want hatcheries. It's not the solution. And last year you left the Yukon River panel, and these words are like burnt into my brain. You walked out of the Yukon River panel saying, we need hatcheries now to save the king salmon. And that is not the solution. It's not what tribes want. And again, I just appreciate the time. I didn't want to testify or be here, but I do care about our people and our salmon. And we are here. We're not leaving. We're going to keep pressuring every single agency until the right decision is made. And that involves you, Doug Vincent Lang. This agreement is, it's scary. You know, the subsistence language is weak, and how powerful that weak language will be once you sign it is very concerning. And then, you know, the marine bycatch comment, you know, that's already used at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. You know, very weak language to address the marine harvest. The North Pacific Council members already use that language, and it's not going to work for this agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Brooke. Well, everybody, thank you for coming out. Thank you for your comments. Commissioner, Danny, thank you both.